Today's program is brought to you by Corin, a supplier of Japanese chef knives and restaurant supplies. For more information, visit corin.com.
This week on Meat and Three, we're exploring interactions from drug studies in a laboratory.
If this effect is as big as he's saying, somebody should have discovered this long before he did.
To global wisdom on avoiding hangovers.
Beber cerveza antes de tomar vino no previene los síntomas.
Bière sur vin et venant, vin sur bière et belle manière.
Beer before wine, you're going to be fine. Wine before beer, you're going to be queer.
To the novel recipes developed by an Indian American family deep in the heart of Texas.
And then my mom's sort of coming to America and learning that white parents love to melt cheese on things to get their kids to eat it. She was like, this is genius.
Be sure to subscribe to Meat in Three. That's M-E-A-T plus sign T-H-R-E-E. Available wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hello, welcome to Japanese. I'm your host, Akiko Tema, food writer and the director of the New York Japanese Culinary Academy, which promotes a deep understanding of Japanese cuisine in America. We are broadcast live from a studio at Wardus in Bushwick, Brooklyn. This show is all about Japanese food and food culture. We see sushi at every deli in the supermarket, but what is beyond sushi? We hear dashi ramen izakaya, but what exactly are they? Japanese food is still a mystery for many people, so I'll try to demystify it in this program with my cool guests. And my guest today is Moe Kuroki, who is the chef owner of Oisa Ramen in Boston. One of my listeners contacted me and said I should definitely have Moe on the show because according to him, she's the most recognizable figure in ramen culture in Boston and also known as a ramen girl. So today we'll find out how a young Japanese woman with no culinary school training, started a super popular ramen shop, and challenges she faced in opening and running a ramen shop, and her signature dishes, and much, much more. But quickly before we start, Japan Eats is available on Heritage Radio Network website, as well as on iTunes, Stitcher, and Spotify as a podcast. So please go to iTunes, Stitcher, and Spotify, and subscribe to Japan Eats. And please write a review. We appreciate your feedback. Also, if you have any ideas about talks of the show or show guests, please let us know, like how we got Moe today. And you can email us at japaneseatheheritageradionetwork.org or at kikokatayama.com. Now let's start a conversation with Moe Kuroki. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So first, this is my regular question. Where are you from and what did you eat when you grew up?
So I am from Fukuoka, Japan. I grew up eating mostly my mom's food, but they both worked, so quite often we also went out to eat. And ramen was one of those things my father would take me after dinner for snack.
Yeah, ramen. Well, first of all, Fukuoka is the mecca of ramen, of tonkotsu soup. And also ramen is always, after drinking, it's a kind of snack. To heal in Japan, anyways. So, okay, and when and why did you come to the U.S.?
I came to United States when I was 15, after graduating from junior high school to attend high school to learn and study English.
So you wanted to leave Japan?
I think my thought of leaving Japan wasn't to leave Japan but I really knew I had to come into the country to learn how to speak English. I wouldn't, you know, in Japan, we have a great school system. You learn from books and you get all this education, but you don't, looking at my sister, she was like perfect student, but she's struggling to actually speak the language itself. And I'm not a studious person. I had to force myself.
Right, but you wanted to use English at some point in your life.
I don't know why.
Right. So maybe you're very open-minded. It was like a destiny to live in the States.
Yeah.
Right. So, okay. And so I heard, that was which year? What year was it that you came to, that was like 15 years ago?
So So now it's 21 years ago.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Nice. So you are completely balanced American girl, I guess.
Yes.
Okay, so, and I heard you studied art.
Yes.
At college.
Yep.
So what happened? How did you get into the food world and in particular ramen?
I think what they're, it's quite often asked. Well, they're both creative. I like to use my hands. And I think, well, you know, my first encounter to the food or the hospitality industry is like, you have to make ends meet. As an artist, you're not making money after you're graduating. So I ended up working at a bar, being a server, and I actually really enjoyed being in the environment of a restaurant. And but I never thought I would be a cook. I'll just continue to serve. And then I ended up being with a person who is a personal chef. And then from there, I think he took me onto different path.
Right. Interesting. Because I found the fact that in 2007, your first sculpture, Jewelry versus Art, was sold at the Must Add auction, being one of the highest bid work.
Yeah.
So you are obviously talented. Yeah, I'm sure that there's an art element in your ball too.
Yeah, I think, I mean, what? Yeah. Sometimes my guests say, you know, I always say, I don't know, I'm not a chef. I don't know how to plate things. Food looks funny. But my guests go, oh, you know what? It shows that you went to art school. You you place things in the way that artists would do.
Like a balance and some accents.
Yeah, the colors and things like that.
Right. Interesting. Right. So, okay. And how did you learn to cook ramen?
Just try and error. But now you can get a lot of information on the internet. So I looked up how to make ramen, just like what everybody else would do. And then, of course, like, my kid's father, he's a personal chef, so from him I learned how to cook or how to just go about maybe cooking broth or stock or things like that. And then having just general idea, and of course seeing my mom cook,
right,
helped too. But it's always like failing
that
teaches you things.
Right, right, yeah. So. I know that personally very well. you know, that you had advantage of born raised in Fukuoka, right?
Yes.
Because tonkotsu, maybe you can just quickly talk about tonkotsu, what it is.
Well, the tonkotsu, so it's funny because when I started first making ramen, to me, like, what is tonkotsu? You know what it tastes like, and you know it's from pork bones, and then they tell, but it's like, when you think about the flavor of pork and the broth, like, it doesn't make sense to me. It's like tonkotsu broth is its own thing.
Right.
And it's like it could come from anything, you know. But so like that's to me is a tonkotsu broth. And it is pork bone broth. I don't know what anyone else does, you know, outside of that rule.
Interesting. So the ramen basically have soy, salt, and tonkotsu. These are the three kings of ramen dashi. Right, and then of course we're going to talk about your vegetarian version later. But so the tonkotsu has, to me, very kind of, you know, the texture is very smoother, thicker, and kind of a collagen-based, kind of rich flavor. Is that how you think is the tonkotsu characteristic?
So I think it's funny, like tonkotsu broth, like has progressed to being like thicker, richer, creamier. But the ones that I grew up eating was actually kind of light. You know, it's soupy, just really salty.
So maybe
more like the Hakata Nagahama style is just really simple.
Right. So just quick, and you have a lot of pork bones, and you just cook it and then make stock.
Some places use the whole head and nothing else. Some people, some places use the trotter or
Oh, it must be really like a little collagen, like smooth. Oh, that sounds great.
Yes, I think, you know, the way I always described making ramen, or, you know, there's always mystery, you know? It's like, you can't, you know, there's pork bones somewhere in the broth.
Right.
But you don't know which part exactly, or what percentage, or the head and head and what else. So I think that, you know, that makes it fun. And I think that made me really curious, you know, like chasing a unicorn.
Yeah. Oh, interesting. That's cute. Right. But I think the ramen is by nature, it's not a fancy food. There's no measuring.
Right.
And you have something available. Yeah. And that's why it's so regional.
Yeah.
Right.
It's true.
So anyway, I think America, that richness appeals to American diners.
Yeah.
That's why I think tonkotsu is, I heard, is most popular.
Popular here, yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So let's talk about your pop-up, which is 3 years, for 3 years before you opened Oisa Ramen.
Yeah.
So how and why start pop-up?
So, I was very curious, again, how to make the soup and see if it's possible, if it's at all a possibility to maybe open a shop. And in order to do that, you want to try. Mm. And I made broth at home, and I ended up making so much. so much so I don't know what to do with. So then, at that point, so my now separated husband, we're good friends, so it's totally fine, but Mike and I were working together, and we've done pop-ups together, which was food and art combined together, and that was our theme. So the concept of pop-up wasn't unfamiliar to me. So I said, okay, well, I'll just throw it onto the Facebook and see where it goes. And it was just donation only. If you want to come, you come. And I just didn't want to waste food. And then at that point, I was still making noodles. Because I couldn't get noodles anywhere else. It took all day long to just pull 45 noodles. But I wanted to learn that aspect too.
Wow, that's huge. Right? I don't know many. There are not many places that can supply good ramen, even like San Noodle.
Yeah.
I think that's where you get the noodles from.
Yeah, the San, yeah.
Right, but yeah, that time, I think lately San Noodle is kind of, you know, staple brand for ramen shops. But yeah, it's interesting because making noodles by itself is an art.
It was a lot of, it was a lot of work. I had tiny little, like, home, just pasta maker. And the ramen noodle, like, the dough, especially for tonkotsu, it's, like, so dry. So to bind it together and then sheet it, to cut it, it was just...
Oh, is it what it is? It's that for tonkotsu, you must make the noodles drier.
Yeah, it has a lower hydration level. So that's why I think traditionally it has smaller portions than like any other ramen style, because it's lower hydration. Once you put it in a hot broth, so it gets soggier quicker.
Right. So it absorbs a lot of fattier.
Right.
Oh, no, I didn't know that. Interesting.
I think that's why the concept of, I don't know which came first, the concept of kaidama is the extra noodle, you know, the portion is small, so the kaidama is there for the tonkotsu style.
Oh, interesting. Oh, for the history. Okay, so, yeah, but how did you find the places to pop up? You have so many, right, for 3 years.
Yeah, so, again, you know, someone like Didi or the friend's a friend, or because being in the industry, and it's relatively small industry, you get to know a lot of chefs and cooks, and you just keep talking. And for me, but I think I've been quite lucky, you know. And ramen is something that's was becoming trendy,
right?
So I had other establishment approach me, like, how about doing an event here, how about this? And then some places I've asked to do a regular monthly pop-ups.
Okay. So you have the space, or you do kind of collaborate and create the menu?
It depends, but mostly I brought my own food in, and then they would have special menu from their kitchen to support the menu, I guess.
Kind of like an appetizer.
Yeah, appetizers, a dessert, or sometimes it's a big collaboration event where I'm one chef, there are other people from other chefs with different skills sharing, mm-hmm. and then we do an event together.
Right. So what kind of restaurants, maybe you can name a few?
So I've done one in a ramen shop. Now I think they're no longer there, but Snappy Ramen. Well, actually, they relocated. That was really fun to be able to work with another ramen chef and see how they operate. And the first big one was at La Brasa. It's in Somerville. And it's a beautiful dining room, huge restaurant.
Mm.
And that was really, really scary.
Mm.
And so just to be in the environment, because I've never cooked in a kitchen before.
Professionally. Right.
So that, and then there is another place that I've done called Brassica Kitchen. That was a monthly based restaurant that I've done the pop-up.
Right. So it sounds like it's not just ramen environment, the kind of...
No. No, and there's always challenges doing a pop-up that's not set up for ramen shops. So it's really nice to have my own little shop and the equipment that's made for ramen. As simple as like cooking noodles seem, if you don't have the pasta boiler that circulates water, you know, not too many places have bowls for ramen. So I had to bring everything with me.
Right.
That was a lot of
That's fascinating. I mean, to me, that's so American. Like, you know, people tend to be, well, this is ramen, has to be separated from this kind of restaurant. But it's kind of like a pasta, you know, that's a different version of pasta. Why don't you just throw in new American cuisine, it's pasta here. Yeah. Maybe you can incorporate the creative idea of ramen, and that's fascinating. Okay, and the chefs are okay. I mean, I'm sure that Western chefs started to open their the ramen shops.
Yeah.
And inspired by how that casual bowl can be creative and so deep.
Everybody's, all the chefs that I've been able to work with been so great. And so, like, they don't hesitate to share. They always teach me what they know and how to navigate the kitchen. I always, like, without being a line cook, I got to be a line cook, if that makes sense. And that was such a great learning experience.
Wow. So you really did, maybe, like, it's like, pop-up was like a school.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right, on the job school. Yeah. That's great. Yeah, so why do you think, you know, I'm sure that there are other ramen projects like pop-ups, but why do you think those became so demanded and popular?
I think, like you said earlier, you know, tonkotsu broth was something that was most popular here. Mm-hmm. And it happens to be the one that I crave the most, because of that's my nostalgic comfort food. And so that, you know, I ended up just serving the most popular style ramen. And I think part of it also is because it was how casual it was, you know, having a ramen in this pop-up environment and just being able to talk to me, also navigating this endeavor of making ramen and figuring it out. So everybody just kind of became friends. It was more like a friendly atmosphere than I'm cooking you food and, you know, it's not a very serious thing. So.
Right. That's very interesting. So this sounds like the community, like the culinary community in Boston is close-knit?
Yeah.
Is it?
And also very open-minded and welcoming in some ways too. And once you tap into that sort of community, and then they will really help you grow.
Right.
Yeah.
Nice. Yeah, so glad that you did it in Boston. So, okay. So, now let's take a quick break here. And when we come back, we'll talk about the Moe's super popular ramen shop, Oisa Ramen, in Boston. So please stay with us. Today's program is brought to you by Corin, a supplier of Japanese chef knives and restaurant supplies. Corin is proud of their Japanese culture and traditions, but they want you to know that their products are not just for Japanese restaurants. The knives and tableware bring out the best qualities of food from every culture and fit into every restaurant, from French to Pan-Asian to American. And that is why they're located in New York City, where people from every country in the world come to eat. Korin's Tribeca showroom is home to the most extensive collection of Japanese chef knives in the world, including Japan. Stop by to view their exquisitely designed tableware and the rarest natural sharpening stones. They have a whole range of knife services, from repair and rust removal to reshaping and realigning. Korin is dedicated to this ideal, bringing the highest quality Japanese design to your table so you can experience the unparalleled quality of Japanese craftsmanship in your home or restaurant. For more information, visit korin.com.
Are you enjoying this podcast? Heritage Radio Network has plenty more. My name is Diane Stemple.
And I'm Elena Santigade, and we're the hosts of Cutting the Curd here on Heritage Radio Network. Featuring interviews with makers and mongers and everybody in between, this show is a downright funky look at the world of artisan cheese.
You can find Cutting the Curd wherever you listen to podcasts and on heritageradionetwork.org.
Welcome back. You're listening to Japanese Broadcasting Live from Studio in Bushwick, Brooklyn. I'm your host, Akiko Tema, and my guest today is Moe Kuroki, who is the chef owner of Oista Ramen in Boston. So when did you open the brick-and-mortar version of your own ramen shop, Oista Ramen?
January 15th, 2018.
Oh, wow.
So about a year and a few months now.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
So, okay, and what's the concept of Oista Ramen?
So, we have a slogan. It's own your slurp and then just slurp and go.
Mm.
So, it is like really fast paced. You come in, slurp and go.
Mm.
You know? And
that's the essential style of Japanese ramen eating.
Yeah.
Right.
When we first opened, we had 4 seats and then just standing bar.
Mm.
Since then, we've installed chairs. But
big progress.
Yeah.
And how many seats now?
Now we have 9 seats.
Oh, almost 2 digits. Wow. Okay, so that size and the pace of eating sounds very, you know, Japanese in essence.
Yeah.
Right. So I think I spoke to someone from Ippudo.
Yeah.
You know, they're surprised that style of dining.
Yeah.
Ramen is completely different.
Different. Yeah, absolutely.
Right. Yeah. And sometimes people enjoy appetizers and conversation so much that they stay like hours and then they don't get to ramen because they're so full. So it sounds like you have the very essential Tampopo style ramen.
Yes, absolutely.
Okay, so what's unique about Oista Ramen compared to other ramen shops?
So, well, one, really the small.
That's charming. Right.
And I think the other thing is that we do offer vegetarian friendly menu as well as tonkotsu on the menu.
Mm.
And you know, I don't feel like my shop is tonkotsu ramen shop. You know, I feel like we're a ramen shop.
Mm.
You know, and like tonkotsu is somewhat of our a signature dish because that's where I started. But I like making vegetable ramen as much as I do tonkotsu.
Mm. So, you know, there is a, of course, trend of vegetarian food demand is getting high, like I think 5% of population looking for vegetarian, and the vegan is like at this point like 2% or something conservatively.
Yeah.
And it's increasing, of course, and especially among a younger generation.
Yeah.
So did you try to meet the demand of the public?
No, I think I was, again, like my motivation for things is just challenging myself or challenging my creativity. I like vegetables and what it can do. And I think maybe part of it was with tonkotsu, I couldn't figure out how much more to be creative. You know, there is a certain way that tonkotsu ramen should be served, or in my head at least. Anyway, I'm pretty much bound to the Hakata-style tonkotsu ramen, and I don't know how to think beyond that, but with vegetable broth, I could think beyond just tradition. You know, it is not, there isn't traditional vegetable broth ramen, at least not that I know of. And so it allowed me to just be really free.
Sounds like your artist nature coming out.
Yeah.
So the vegetable, basically, you know, the stock is usually made with, like, say, kombu or bonito. Like, there's always animal element, but you have to eliminate it.
Yeah.
So
the hardest thing that I had to eliminate was bonito.
Yeah.
I love the taste of bonito and the stock without it.
Mm.
You know, dashi without bonito feels forever to me is missing something.
Mm.
So now I added a new menu item called dashi niku.
Mm.
And then that we have bonito.
Okay.
Blend it with the veggie broth.
Mm.
So it's still lighter broth, but it has that umami from bonito.
Right. Because bonito, it takes months and months to smoke and the cure. And it's such a, you know, craftsmanship in really incorporated into the process. But, well, that's the smokiness, right?
Yeah.
And some, of course, a deep meat flavor of bonito.
So savory.
Right. But how do you realize that kind of depth in vegetarian version?
It's so funny. Like, my broth is so very simple. I use the simple mirepoix plus kelp, and that's it.
Mm.
And everything, I don't know. I've tried different methods. I tried miso, I tried this, I tried that. And it ended up being just simple. Vegetable broth, it's sweet, it's nice. You know, it is sweeter than what maybe everybody's used to in terms of ramen broth, because we use
carrots
and
I would love that. Interesting. So, because I think we perceive ramen as something salty.
Yeah.
But by incorporating sweetness, you kind of round out the flavor.
And instead of having the broth, so broth too salty, I think what I end up doing is making the toppings a little bit more salty.
Mm.
So you take a bite of toppings and then you slurp. And then at the end you can, you know, finish the soup and not being too salty.
So. Oh, that's desirable. Yeah, because if you go to normal ramen shop, and I really feel like drinking kind of gallons of water literally.
Yeah,
so you don't have to have that. By the way, what's the meaning of oisa?
Oisa is a rhythmic chant. There's a festival in Fukuoka called Yamakasa Festival. It's one of the big festivals, and they carry giant, like, portable shrine and run through the city. And while they're running, they chant oisa, oisa, oisa.
Mm.
So the word itself, I don't know what it really
it's
means.
It's kind of like a go-go kind
go,
of.
Go-go, yeah.
Mm.
And I picked it because it relates back to my hometown. And if you're from Fukuoka, it'll be like, oh, that's what it's from. You know?
Right. Yeah. Okay, and then I eat quick. Oisa, oisa. Maybe. Okay, so, but sounds like, you know, go back to your ramen. So do you call yourself kind of traditional after going through creative path?
Yeah. I think being Japanese and coming from the culture, I hold the word traditional very highly. So for me to be able to call whatever I do traditional, I don't feel like I'm worthy to do that. But, you know, I am a student of the craft, and, you know, what I can say is I feel though it's authentic,
and
because I can't do anything about the palette that I have, and then the palette I have is authentic Japanese because that's what I grew up eating.
Right.
So even if I make Italian food, it tastes like Japanese food.
Interesting. Right. So that authenticity, it's kind of programmed in your head.
Yeah.
And I think by being here in Boston, you're creating that authenticity to something, a little new version, new generation version of it. That's awesome. Okay, so what are your signature ramen balls?
So, as I mentioned, tonkotsu is the signature, or that's the beginning, I think. And then I have a vegan dish called smoky shoyu, and I feel like shoyu ramen is the original classic ramen. So I felt the need to have that classic shoyu ramen, but again with vegetable broth, because that's what I felt most connected to.
Right.
And then, I mean, I only have 4 ramen dishes.
Yeah, well, 4 guests, that's like great.
Yeah. And then I have fun vegetarian one that has truffle oil and has a nice aroma, so it's a little twist. And then dashiniku with beef and onsen egg, and it tastes like nikudon but with ramen version.
Okay. Wow. So which one is your customer's favorite statistically?
Tonkotsu. But it's funny, like non-vegan vegetarian guests still like to eat the smoky shoyu and truffle shoyu, and once they pick the one they like, they don't get anything else.
Interesting.
So I have like probably 60% regular guests, and I see them and exactly I know how they like their food.
Right. Well, but it's a big compliment, right? Because well, somebody wanted, this is mine.
Yeah.
I'm not going to do anything else.
Yep.
Right. Wow. I have to go to Boston and try ramen. Okay. And you said you're getting your noodles from San Noro?
Yep.
Yeah. So and I know that your business partner also is a George girl from San Noro. And by the way, George, I've known him for a while, but he's amazing, super knowledgeable.
Yeah. Right. So I know what I know from him, too. He teaches me a lot, too. So.
Right. So how do you describe? I mean, you could, if you try, if you don't sleep, maybe you can make your own noodles. But what's the criteria of good noodles for ramen?
I think for me, so the reason why I don't make my own is because one, yes, San Noro is great, and it's not just a time, but they have ability to buy flowers from different places that's specifically grown and made for making ramen, and they have technology to just really manipulate and make great noodles, which, you know, like I could just struggle and struggle and struggle and fail many times to maybe get to, but I wouldn't have, being a small shop 9-seater, I wouldn't have an ability to carry 2 different styles of ramen. And, you know, it's also the consistency, right?
It's another Japanese craftsmanship, right? If you know the best, you just ask.
Yeah.
Work with the best rather than you try to do all.
Right.
So, okay. So what's, I'm sure that I heard you can customize your recipes and your whatever. So how do you describe your noodles?
So I carry, from San Noro, I carry 2 different styles of ramen. One is for traditional Hakata style, super thin, straight. And I describe it as crunchy noodles.
Oh.
So it's not chewy, bouncy noodles. That's, it's just, and it's dry. So that's the tonkotsu I have. And then the other one I have for shoyu ramen is tomato noodle. So like you said, you know, how do I come about adding that layer of umami into vegetables that's missing protein, and tomato has a lot of umami, and so what they do is they use, I think, 10% of sun-dried tomato powder into the noodle, so the noodle themselves have this like sweet, tangy, packed in umami flavor, and then that combined with, you know, vegetable broth, it just made a lot of sense to me.
Right.
So that one is a thicker, curly, chewy, what you maybe what a lot of guests are more used to, being ramen noodle.
Right. Wow, that's interesting. So I'll let you next time I go to Boston. It's really fascinating.
Please,
Okay. And So it's been over a year since you opened Oisa Ramen. So why do you think Oisa Ramen is so popular?
Why do we? I think because we're welcoming of a lot of different cultures and guests, and you know, my menu shows that we're very welcoming and open. And I think the fact that we feel though we're a traditional ramen shop, traditional small ramen shop, but because I've lived here so long, we don't carry that sort of maybe not uptight but scary energy, you know. I'm more like Americanized, and we don't say hello in Japanese, we greet guests in English,
right.
Say thank you in English, you know. And and a lot of guests ask me like, oh, how am I supposed to go about eating this? I'm like, however you want. You want to eat it with fork, please do. You know, and that makes people feel comfortable, and then that makes them want to maybe come back. And then, you know, when once you make the connection with guests, and I'm always there talking and talking and talking. So we become friends, and then they bring their friends, and I think it just feels like just family.
In essence, Japanese mom and pop ramen shop works like that. So. Right. Okay. And it's the customers are everybody, like you said?
Yeah. Everybody. Even though we're so small, we try to accommodate the best we can. Obviously, if you come as guest of 12, we don't have seats at all.
Right.
But even like guests come with strollers or babies, and I end up holding the babies. And
that's an extra super service. Right. Okay. Well, this is a huge question, but what are some of the biggest challenges opening and running a ramen shop in Boston?
Like, you know, I think the first challenge was really installing the idea of what really ramen culture is in Japan and how different it is in here. You know, I think especially for my shop, I mean, you can't sit there too long. You really have to slurp and go. And also we don't do takeout ramen. And you know, now maybe once a week or so we get guests asking, why don't you do the takeout? And I'm like, I'd rather not take your money and disappoint you now than to take your money and then have you be disappointed later. But when we first opened, oh boy, it was like every day many guests being angry, just like, but you know, I think now we have guests who are coming back just to experience. So I think that those two things were the hardest thing, operating.
Right. So you have to show who you are.
Yeah.
Mm.
And I was so many times tempted to say yes, but I'm glad I didn't. And those are, you know, and I'm lucky because I listened to the chefs who's had the restaurants, and they're like, you know, you're going to have to stick to what you do because you can't cater to everybody anyway.
Right. Yeah, and then the customers move on in, you know, the times of all those reviews and social media. Right. So, yeah, so your identity, that's the foundation of your place. Okay, so what are some of the greatest experiences in running a ramen shop?
Just meeting people, you know, and how generous they can be. And And because our shop is so small, it's almost like we're running like a social experiment, you know? Like, but everybody's accommodating to one another, and then they start speaking to each other and then leave the shop as if they were friends. So to see that, you know, and to be able to carry a place that everybody feels relaxed and really welcomed, like, that makes me so happy, just seeing guests be happy. I think that's the best thing.
Right. So I'm curious how your parents say about your place.
You know, it's, I think about that too. I think they're, my mom is mostly worried.
Like, that's mom.
She's like, I can't believe you work so much. And, you know, I'm worried that, you know, take it easy sometimes. And I think my father would have been proud knowing that, you know, ramen is kind of was our thing. Mm-hmm. And I was his tag along. I just went with him. And, you know, my mom doesn't like tonkotsu ramen either.
That's why she's worried about it. She doesn't get it. Right. Oh, that's funny. Right. Yeah, but the community feeling, especially, you know, you have to go through a lot of hard things and running a restaurant, which is obviously very hard. Yeah. So you have a lot of regulars?
I have a lot of regulars. Mm. And it's really nice. You know, they... And I know I have a ramen shop, but I feel like I have a traditional bar where guests come in and they wind down over a glass of cocktails or wine or whatever. Mm. Instead of they're just winding down a bowl of ramen, telling them how there's been. And I think that's why we have a lot of regulars.
Right. So you can just stop in because it's your place to be. Nice. Okay. So what is your plan?
My plan for the future, I guess, is for me, get the shop to the place where I can step away for a little bit and or a day or two, or and then I want to learn more from different chefs by doing pop-ups or collaborations. So that's my next step, I guess.
Interesting. So are you interested in learning from, say, like Italian chef or the kind
absolutely.
Of... Yeah, interesting.
I think, again, at my heart, I respect tradition, but am I a follower of tradition? I don't know. You know, I'm too kind of free-spirited and creative to just follow the path, even though, like, I have so much respect for tradition, and sometimes I wish I could be, you know, one of the best at the craft, but I don't think that's in my nature.
Right, but you never know. Right. Okay, so where can we find more about Oishisan Ramen?
I would say two places. The website, oishisanramen.com, and Instagram is where I post a lot of pictures and information about upcoming events. So those are the two places.
Okay, great. All right, so thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Yeah, so please make a post it and then maybe you can come back when you do some interesting pop-up.
Yes.
Okay, so listeners, if you have any questions or comments about the show or suggestions for show topics or guests, please contact us at japanese@heritageradionetwork.org or akikokatema.com. Japan Needs is live at 3 p.m. on Mondays and always available at heritageradionetwork.org, iTunes, Stitcher, and Spotify as a podcast. Our engineer is Matt Patterson, and thank you for listening. I'll see you next week.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to learn more about our 10-year anniversary celebration happening all year long, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.